Today is Thursday, March 9th, 2023. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Schulz. Charlie spells his last name S-C-H-U-L-Z. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Charlie. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Great. Charlie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You do have my permission.
Thank you. Charlie, in the end of the last interview, you recounted this amazing rainstorm that caught you at Havasupai Gardens, and y'all got ushered into a building there for some hours, kind of head to toe, packed in this thing, trying to get a little sleep while the rain pounded down. And then the rain quit, and that was the end of that. You lost your tube tent, I guess. What did you do after that hike? That was June of 1981. What did you do after that?
Okay. Well, then it was, you know, back to the regular routines, and then I wanted to get back to the Grand Canyon again. So in July of 81, my son at that time was about 9 years old.
Okay.
And I had tried to, you know, over time get him interested in doing a little hiking and stuff like that. So the two of us went to the Grand Canyon, and we hiked down Hermit to Santa Maria and over to Dripping Springs and then back up around. And
was that as a day hike, or were you going to backpack that? Okay.
Yeah, it was a day hike. And I found he wasn't terribly excited about the hiking part.
Uh-huh. In July? Okay.
Pardon?
In July?
I probably didn't, I probably had trouble remembering what I felt like when I was his age and, my father maybe trying to drag me around, but my father and I didn't have that kind of relationship, so maybe that's probably why I didn't have quite the understanding, but I'm not sure. In any case, he wasn't too excited with that. In fact, we had not really the Grand Canyon. We then, about a month later, went up to Flagstaff, and we hiked up, or took the, at that time, you could take the ski lift up to, on Schulz Peak, I think it is, it's called. And then you could, at that time, they don't allow it anymore, I don't believe, you could hike up to the top of that.
Of Agassiz, maybe.
And, yeah, Agassiz, yeah.
Okay.
And he said to me, did your father make you do this?
Oh.
And so I knew I was losing the battle here, so we didn't do too much hiking together after that. For quite a while, quite a few years, I should say.
Did he eventually come back around to backpacking?
No. He'll do some hiking with me and stuff like that, and he has in the past for, and he's done a little bit with his son, my grandson, and my grandson's gone out with me a couple times as well.
Okay.
But my son does not want to backpack. He's a car camper. He doesn't mind that. He's got a big trailer, and
okay.
He and his kids have been all over the U.S.
Oh, cool.
And stuff like that. So they do go places and see things and get out in nature. He likes to fish. He goes to Pennsylvania and some other places to fish, streams and all that kind of stuff. So he does get out. It's just not, he's never been the backpacker or anything to go very far. So.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
So some of that traveling tradition then still continues in the family. So that's good.
Right.
Yeah.
And then my next trip to the Grand Canyon was, it was my first rim to rim. And that was on October 3rd of 1982. And it was with a Southern Arizona Roadrunners.
Okay, so hang on a second. I've got down that you did a hike in May of 82 with CL.
That's right. Did I skip? Oh, I'm looking at my notes. I went too far. I'm sorry.
Okay,
I backed up.
Okay, no worries.
No, October of 1981, first of all, I did a rim-to-rim backpacking with a group of people from work. We got two vans. One went to the north rim, the other the south rim. And then we hiked and we met in Cottonwood and exchanged keys. And one group went one way and the other group went the other way. And so the only problem with that was that the people that came with the band to the north rim had a problem. And they actually had to send it to Kanab to get it fixed.
Oh, no.
And they were dropped off. So when we got to the rim, we had to call the company in Kanab and have them bring the van back out. And then, of course, we had to pay the bill.
Oh, boy.
And we just, at least for me, that was kind of the last time I was going to try that. And I kind of organized it, thought I had all this worked out. So I felt kind of bad because everybody that was with me, when we got to the north rim, of course, I had to wait around until we could get the van back and all that kind of stuff. So it was, everybody made it both ways, you know, as far as the hiking and the backpacking and all that. But
so I'm looking at this, Charlie, and I'm going, okay, so you did this hike in June, and then you were back with your son in July, and then you were back again in October.
Right.
You're kind of liking this.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting infatuated with the Grand Canyon, I guess you could say.
Okay, good. I see that. Yeah. So the rim to rim. That October with that October with your workmates without CL.
Right.
Besides the van, what else do you remember about that?
Because we were coming from the South Rim to Cottonwood in one day, it was a pretty good hike, and some of the people struggled a little bit. But the next day, we were out from Cottonwood to the rim in about 4 or 5 hours. I mean, the last ones coming out were about 4 to 5 hours out, coming out. And that it's a pretty good rise coming out of there. So, and not all of them were in real great shape, but everybody made it out. You know, we shared ideas as far as what food to bring, but everybody kind of took care of themselves.
Okay.
You know, and a couple of them were couples, so they took care of, you know, the two of them as far as cooking food.
Mm-hmm.
So at Cottonwood, we had a little group campground there again that we used. It was the same one where the skunks were when we came down with CL that first time earlier that year. And so the skunks didn't miss us. They were back. and then that little campground must have, I don't know if it still does to this day, but those little, they're not the big ones. They're the little ones that are kind of spotted white and black. That like to hang out there. I guess they see all that free food. It's almost every night they got somebody to choose from.
So. You know, they're throughout the river corridor as well in the river camps.
Oh, okay.
And so they're, they're out there.
Yeah, yeah. And, and they do fine. That was probably the biggest thing was, you know, the campground and the skunks still being there, even though it had been, you know, we were there in June, and here it was October, and they may have even hung out saying, well, they'll be back. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they were looking online at the permits, going, oh, these guys are going to be coming back. They were good food source. So let's wait for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
They had good foods.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest thing. Again, it's one of those things, because I organized it, I was a little worried about making sure everybody got out and those kind of things. So it does distract sometimes from what you're doing when you're worrying a little bit about what other people are doing and if they're doing all right and all that kind of stuff.
And it is, as you say, a little ambitious because the people going the other way, and you had worked this out differently on your first hike. You'd gone from the North Rim to Cottonwood. And then Cottonwood to Havasupai Gardens, and then up to the rim on the third day, after your second night, the people going from north to south on this October 1981 trip, were they going to go from Cottonwood to the South Rim all in one day?
Yep.
How did they do?
Well, you know the thing was I didn't have to face them until Monday at work. You know, I don't remember exactly if we were on a holiday weekend. That probably wasn't October. Well, it might have been Veterans Day because that was right about the right time. So we might have been off and had a 3-day weekend. But in any case, you know, once a day or two passes, people tend to calm down. So I'm sure if I'd been at the trailhead when they got up there, there would have been a different discussion. But they moaned and groaned. We all did, of course, at that point, because we were all still novices at this. I mean, even going to South Rim to Cottonwood, it was not as hard as the other way, certainly.
Right.
But it's still a long day.
It is.
We had the long day the first day. They had the long day the second day.
And
their first day. They had the long drive.
Yeah.
Hike down.
Did you assume, well, you know, we did that in two nights last time. We can do it in one this time.
We couldn't get the permits.
Ah. And this is 1981. You couldn't get the permits.
Right. We couldn't get the permits for any other.
So, okay.
You know, so everybody knew what they were getting into. From the point of view of what they were going to have to do, I don't know if they knew what they were getting into from the point of view of what that meant. There was another time, and I couldn't find it, or I can't remember finding it, and that was we did another trip to Havasupai. And that one I can remember walking out with a couple of people where, you know, it's one of those things where if you keep them talking, they don't think about what they're doing and how miserable they're feeling.
Right.
And so that last bunch of switchbacks coming up to the parking lot there at where you come out of Havasupai, I talked two people up through that. One, I got them to the top, and then I went back down and talked the other one up through it as well. So it was one of those things. You know, if you decide you're going to organize one of these things, you kind of have to step up a little bit to take or help the people out too. So
yes, yeah, that's right. You've got to take care of your people.
Yep.
You bet.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's October
1981.
Okay. Then what was your next hike?
Okay, then the next one. I was looking. You know, as I mentioned before, I was teaching part time at Glendale Community College, and I looked online for their spring non-credit courses to see if there was another Grand Canyon one. And sure enough, CL and his friend were doing another one that was going to be down to Bill Hall to Thunder River and to Peach Creek down in that area off the North Rim.
Okay.
And so I signed up for that one, and we hauled water down and made a water stash partway down. And then from there, continue on down to the Thunder River, just above it, and camped. And then went down. There was a, I don't know if it's still there. I haven't been there in years. But there used to be a, you know, one of the primitive toilet things that they built for a while with a wall around it, kind of a, you know, it was in Peach Creek. There was a...
Right.
Bathroom thing, and I have no idea if it's still there now or not. It's been so long ago, and I've not been up from the river for a long time either, but so I don't know if it's still up in there. But anyway, we camped in that general area, and this time again CL's daughter and a friend went along. This time they were in great shape, so the three of us kind of were out in front and got down there, and Thunder River was just amazing. You know, the first time you see it, that water coming pouring out of the side of the cliff is just, you know, just really amazing.
Yeah.
And then we got down to the creek, and we all set up our camp there. And again, there were some other people along in that by the time we got there, they were kind of shocked. So the next day, there wasn't a lot going on, and a couple of us went on down to the river, and this was in May. Yeah. Yeah, May. And there was a private raft trip down the river, and I was relating this to somebody last night at dinner because it happened to us twice. They were nude on the river trip. And it's kind of shocking when you come across, you know, coming around the corner and there's people walking up the trail coming towards you that don't have any clothes on.
In the desert, so, yeah, with cactus and all that stuff.
Yeah, and all that stuff. I mean, they had sandals on, but that was, you know, kind of it. And they turned around. This group turned around and took off. Other time was up in Nankweep, and they just stopped and talked to us. They didn't turn around anything. So, in any case, that was kind of the high point of that day. And then we worked our way over to Deer Creek and, you know, down to the river from, you know, Deer Creek down that through that little chasm and down the trail to the river and then back up again, and then camped there above Deer Creek and then back up onto the Esplanade where we had stashed the water. And then we came out on Indian Hollow coming back out.
Oh, wow.
So we had 4 days, I think, or 3.5 days, something like that.
So when you did your first water stash, did you hike the water down to the top of the Esplanade and then hike back up to get your packs? Or did you...
No, we hauled the water down with us.
Hauled it down, then just hit it, dropped it, and then headed off to Pete's Creek.
Right.
Got it. So then coming back up, you had a dash of water there, because that walk from top of the Esplanade to Bill Hall Trail Junction, that's a bunch of miles. It's on the Esplanade. It's fairly flat. Nice walking to get over to Indian Hollow.
Yeah, and there was no water, of course, in, up there, so we've been warned. I think, in fact, it's probably out of Harvey's Grand Canyon Trek's One that, you know, need to make sure you stash water or something like that, because we knew enough to do that. And to bring down water. So everybody carried a 1 gallon jug, like a milk jug of water. And there were like 8 of us. So we had 8 gallons of water there when we got down there and got a place to stash it.
Right. So glad to get rid of that on your way down and
deal
with it later. Had you been in contact with CL that winter, or were you guys still kind of connecting and you know, saying, oh, well, you know, you seem to be liking this hiking, and well, so do you. And, you know, how did that friendship get started?
Yeah, well, that was kind of where it started after this trip. Before that, no, we kind of got to talking either during this trip or after the trip, and I can't, you know, really put it in context in that regard. But he said to me, you know, I really like to do some more hiking in the canyon, and you seem like you would too, and we're kind of like-minded, and we hike same speed, and would you want to get together and do some other hiking without all these other people? And I said, that'd be great. And so that's when we started arranging to do other trips and stuff like that without Glendale Community College.
Okay.
Involvement and any of that stuff after that. So that was the second trip. We kind of decided we were going to jump off and do our own thing.
You'd mentioned some things about CL that you didn't mention on the last time about his work history. Can you cover that now?
Sure. I don't know how much Frank may have told you. I mean, CL was an athlete in high school, played baseball and all this stuff. He was kind of a natural athlete from everything that I learned from other people as well,
okay.
From other of his friends. And when he went in the Air Force, I went in the Air Force, I got sent off to training school and off to do things. When he went in the Air Force, they sent him to play baseball.
Oh, wow.
He was actually part of a baseball team that went around to different bases and all this kind of stuff. So, and he had, I think, at one point in time, made an attempt to go pro. And there was a guy who was on the weather or on the news channel, sports guy from in Phoenix on one of the TV channels that had been a pro baseball player. And I cannot remember his name, I'm sorry. But he and CL had been classmates and had played together on the same team.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I just don't remember his name right now. I'm sorry. But in any case, after he got through that, he had started at the University of Arizona, and after a little bit, he dropped out and down the state. And that's where he finished his degree and stuff. He got a job with the government doing survey work. And one of his first jobs then was dropped down onto the, where the Little Colorado and the Colorado River come together by helicopter. And they were starting the survey of the area where they were going to put a dam in Marble Canyon at one time, where there was discussion about that. And he was part of that survey team. And I don't remember a lot of the details. I thought it was kind of cool. But he talked about, you know, they'd fly him food in and they'd fly him out. So it was like, it wasn't like a day or two. It was like they were down there for a couple months and they would fly him in and out and they would fly food and stuff in and out. doing that survey work, and they were up that canyon on both sides and doing that work. And he just said that was what they did. That was their job, was to, you know, do what they had to, find elevations and all that kind of stuff.
I don't think he was
doing the boring or anything like that to, you know, check the canyon walls with regard to porosity or stability or anything. It was just strictly, you know, measuring where this was and that was, and you know, elevations on the rim and elevations on the river and other obstacles that might be in the way in making measure and mapping it essentially what was in there.
Right.
And that was and then he went from that, and he did some other jobs as well. Similar work for the government in Arizona, and he used to talk about some of the places and all the snakes and everything else when they're out there walking around doing the surveying.
So let me make sure I get this right.
Whenever they need it. So it might be in the middle of summer, or it might be, you know, if it's hot in the summer, then of course they're going to work in the late afternoons and early mornings.
Right.
And that's when the snakes are out as well. So he talked about, you know, all the snakes they would see and stuff like that.
Yeah. Was this
interesting work, but then he married Kathy, and I think that kind of got him into deciding, and she had two kids already, so he went into, found a position with a farmer's, it was FHA, it's not homeowners, or anyway, it was a part of the government that was set up to loan money to farmers and ranchers and so on for wells and building construction and stuff like that. So
okay, so hang on, Charlie, hang on a second.
We were doing all of our backpacking stuff together. That's when he was doing that.
So hang on a second. I'm trying to clarify this out. The Arizona Power Authority was a branch of the state government, and they were in Marble Canyon looking at the dam site, the Marble Canyon dam site, in the mid-1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm assuming he was working for the state.
Well, that I'm not sure of. I thought it was federal government, but maybe it was the state, but it may have been a contractor that somebody hired.
Okay.
Because he went to work for the for the government, for sure.
Right.
I don't know how that transition occurred. I don't know if it occurred because he was part of a government contract company or if he was actually a government employee at that time. I'm not sure.
Okay. And then he ended up working with Frank Barrios for the Bureau of Reclamation.
Yes.
And Frank spent some time in that same program doing water development for agriculture.
Right. And then that was where CL moved from that into FHA.
Okay. All right. So he had, before you kind of really got to know him, he had done a ton of hiking in remote areas. So all this trail stuff would have been easy for him.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I mean, when we started going together, I mean, as far as hikes, probably the hardest or the only hike that we really did that involved the normal trails was the very first one on the north-south on North Kaibab and Bright Angel. After that, we were either off on trails that were at that time not very heavily used or even cross-country in some cases. So
okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you for getting that background in there on Claude.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was May of 82.
Right.
Where'd you guys go from there?
Well, the next one, this one I did by myself. I went back up there again in July. and I went from Hermit down to Dripping Springs again, and then back via, I don't know if you're familiar with that area in detail, but there's a place called Horse Thief Tank.
Okay.
And so I was by myself, and went up to there, and there's a road, the dirt road that runs back there, and you can go back to the east and hook through the forest and come back out to Hermit's Rest.
Right, on the boundary line road.
Yes, yeah. But after a while, I cut off the boundary line road and just the rim a ways, but back to Hermit's Rest that way.
Right.
And that was the first time I heard a mountain lion.
Oh, wow.
And I had no idea until I described it to somebody. I said, oh, that was a mountain lion. Because, you know, the screaming, it's not a roar. It's a scream almost like that comes from them. So anyway, that was on a day hike all by myself. And then the next one was October 3rd of 82. And this was the first rim-to-rim run. And this was done with the Southern Arizona Roadrunners. And we did it just on the Kaibab, down the North Kaibab and up the South Kaibab. And this one was also kind of a strange one. I had started running in the, I think I mentioned that there were guys that I met at work, and they were running in one of them in the other cubicle noticed this thing in one of the local, I guess, Southern Arizona, you know, they used to put out a little paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we signed up for it. So a bus came from Tucson, and then they had a second bus of people from the Phoenix area, and they bused us up to the North Rim, and we spent the night, and then the next morning they dropped us off at the top of the North Kaibab and went across, and we came up the South Kaibab. And they had made arrangements with people who, they were volunteers, young people who were working for, I don't know who was running the hotel system at that time on the South Rim. But anyway, they volunteered and carried water down to the top of the trail where you come up out of the river on the North or South Kaibab. And then again, when you get up onto the place where they bring the mules down and tie them up, and there's a bathroom there.
Yep.
So we had water at two places on the way up, so we didn't have to carry as much water and not come up to Bright Angel. And this is another one where the guy that got me into this part way up, he said, I'm going to never, you know, he says, I don't think I can make it. He says, I may fall off the side of the trail. If I don't make it, tell him to look down there or something. And so we got to the top, and they had raised a banner, and we got T-shirts and everything else. Well, they got in trouble for that. At that time, and I still think it's really the park's policy, the national park policy, is you can't have an organized event in the park like that.
Right.
Competitive event. And so the people who organized it had actually been doing it for 5 or 6 years. And that was the year after there was a guy from, and I should have looked up the name. I know I still have that paper. From Williams, who had been running rim to rim for years and actually set the record at that time.
That would have been Al Cureton.
Yes, yes. And he was with us on this one as well.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you remember about him?
He was kind of a character. And he told us a whole bunch of stuff about his, you know, his background and stuff. His dad had a hardware store in Williams.
Yep.
And used to take him around with him to Kanab on, you know, they were making deliveries of stuff from the hardware or lumber store or whatever. And he used to drop him off, you know, Alan said, you know, I want to go across the canyon. So his dad would drop him at the North Rim and say, don't make me wait. His dad would drive around, and Ellen would be at the South Rim when he got there. So, you know, that's
oh my
when
gosh.
He started running the rim. And I may have an interview that they did with him. I think I still have that paper. If I do, I'll find it, and I can, you know, copy it and send it to you.
That'd be great. You know. Yeah, yeah, I'd love to see that, and I'll pass that on to the museum collection at Grand Canyon National Park if they don't have it.
If I could, you know, I don't need the paper. I could send you the paper for that matter.
Sure, I'll just pass it on over to them.
And, you know, he was a really interesting person, but his whole thing was, you know, he lived a fairly simple life was the implication. He didn't really, I didn't get the feeling he was married or they had any kids
nope.
or anything like that.
Yep.
And he was running. And then he turned out later that I found out that he, Bouchard, he had done a number of trips with him as well.
That's right.
At this canyon. And
with Harvey Bouchard.
Yeah, with Harvey Bouchard. And that Harvey kind of told him the same thing, you know, you got to keep up, kid. Kyrie was kind of reluctant to take anybody after he had somebody that had, you know, from the NAU, had somebody that drowned on one of his river crossings. And so I guess that was when Ellen showed that he could keep up, then Harvey was all right with him coming along. So he did do some trips into the canyon with Harvey Bouchard as well.
Yeah, yeah. So hang on a second. Let's back up a bit. The Southern Arizona Roadrunners had been doing these crossings. It sounded like this was their, as you mentioned, their fifth year. But the park was becoming concerned. I mean, two buses, you must have had, 50 to 60 people in the group, I'm assuming?
Yeah, easily.
Okay.
They probably went a little too far, but they actually put a banner up over the South Kaibab trailhead, you know, finish, you know, rim to rim, all that. And I think, you know, for other people who were coming to the park, it was kind of like, you know, what the heck's going on or what's this deal? So I think they went too far. They made too much of it. Hmm. And that's probably what got them into trouble.
Okay.
When, you know, a few years later, when we started doing the same thing, it was a much smaller group, of course, but we tried to keep it much more low-key. We didn't have any banners over the trail.
Or get volunteers to bring water down.
No,
all that kind of stuff.
No, no.
But at that time, 1982, y'all were aware that Allen had the speed record.
Yep.
And
said it the year before.
And people were thinking about that.
Yep.
Okay. And do you remember what your time was?
5:35. I had it in my notebook. I looked it up.
Okay. That's pretty good, because I think the record at the time was 3 and many minutes. That would have been Allen. So you weren't.
Yep.
You weren't doing too bad.
No, I was 2 hours behind him. There was no way I was in that class. I can guarantee it.
Yeah, but you were in the 5-hour class, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's going to knock that.
And the guy that got me into it came out another half hour later. So.
Oh.
I felt vindicated to a certain extent.
Was CL on that trip?
No. That was, you know, we had done the Hermit Dripping Springs, and then we didn't do anything until April of 83, then. That was our next one.
Okay. And so did the Roadrunners, were they just basically told cease and desist by the Park Service?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
that stopped it. Then they never did another organized one after that, as far as I know.
Okay. Do you remember at the time what the Park Service was concerned about?
I think the big thing was that their people having to go down and rescue people.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know that occurred on any of these, but it doesn't mean that it didn't occur, you know, on some other groups or something like that. I don't remember anybody getting hurt or anybody having to be hauled out or anything like that. You know, there was no delay when we got back to the north or to the south rim. You know, as the buses loaded up there at the trailhead, then they headed out when everybody was up. So.
Okay.
It wasn't anything this group did that I know of, but I thought it was an interpretation of their policy, because just a heads up, I got a letter like that 15 years later.
Okay.
Saying cease and desist. And I'll cover that, you know, later on if you want.
Yeah, when we get there, sure, you bet.
No, I got the same thing. And we had really tried to keep it low key, and they still detected that something was going on, and I got a letter from the Park Service saying, stop doing that.
You know, as a backpacker, who's got a heavy load, carrying a lot of water, you know, five and a half hours to get from the rim to Phantom Ranch is pretty good. You know, 5.5 hours to get from the rim to Havasupai Gardens is pretty good. You know, 5.5 hours to get from Cottonwood to the North Rim is pretty good. Were you aware as a backpacker and a runner that there may be some irritation between the people that are moving under heavy load and the people that are moving very lightly and very fast?
I was probably too naive to pay much attention to it. I was more worried about tripping and hopping over all the water bars and getting by. And at that particular run, I don't remember much about anything except trying to make sure I got myself out of there.
Right.
I wasn't focused on anybody else on the trail except, okay, am I doing this right? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Am I drinking enough water? And that kind of stuff. And I'm sure there were people who were purists about this, even to this day. You know, right now, 7 years ago, I worked with the University of New Mexico and the Grand Canyon on their program where they were doing health checks and measurements on rim-to-rim runners in October.
Okay.
And it was 3 days. It started on a Friday afternoon. It ended like Sunday evening. And there were a bunch of us that volunteered. But there were like 2,000 people.
Wow.
They were doing the rim-to-rim. It was just amazing how many people. And then I was up there this last October, and it just happened to be the weekend of people doing it. And it was, again, it was 1,000 people or 2,000 people, whatever. It's just become a major thing in the running world as far as endurance running, you know, the trail runs and that kind of stuff, to do a rim-to-rim and then doubles. And then I was one of our runs, we ran into a guy who was doing a quadruple.
Right.
And I just thought, wow, you people are nuts.
Says the guy who's doing the rim to rim, as the backpackers are walking along, looking at the rim to rimmers, going, "You people are nuts." Just thinking.
So, you know, it's from the perspective is everything, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
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 So. So that was the adventure for the first rim to rim.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you about this. What would you do? Sure. And again, this is October 1982. When, you know, because you got your watch and you're thinking about your time. You don't want to be too fast. You don't want to be too slow. You need to pace yourself, but you need to compete and you need to win. Yeah, win, but you need to finish the run.
Yeah.
When you ran into a mule train, what would you do?
Well, you had to do what they tell you. Get the heck off the trail.
Okay. So you're standing there, kind of catching your breath, I guess, taking a little rest.
Yeah.
While they go by, but you're watching your watch going, well, I just lost, you know, 5 minutes here.
And especially if they stop, you know, to let the mules relieve themselves, then you got to stop because you can't go around them while they're doing that.
Right.
And then they got to start up again and keep going. And you just got to stand there. You don't have any, I mean, those, and I don't blame them, the guys that, the wranglers, you know, they don't want anybody throwing off a mule and hurt.
Exactly.
You know, they don't know how the mule's going to react, so they yell at you, you know, stand still, stay off the trail until we get done here, or whatever, you know. And I'm sure they put up with not only runners, but backpackers and everybody
else. That's
right,
that's right.
Try and get them. And they can't, you know, risk the, put the people there on the,
right.
On the animals at risk.
Day hikers, I mean, anybody who's out on the trail for whatever reason
is gonna
encounter... you know, again, here's yet another different type of transportation, where someone's running, or they're just out for a walk, or they're walking under the load of their own pack, or they're on a mule. Just different types of transport there. Okay.
And so, I mean, as far as you know, just in general, over the years, almost all my running with CL and even with other folks. It became a lot more trail running and stuff. So we interfaced with stock all the time.
Huh.
And it was just trail etiquette. Get off the trail and wait for them to get by.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
And you live with it. That's part of what it, if you're going to run trails, you're going to run into stock. And you live with that situation. So.
You bet. Okay. So that's October 82. Then where did you go?
Okay. Then I went back to the Grand Canyon 2 weeks later.
So still in October?
Yep. 10:15 to 22, and went with CL and his stepson and one other guy that he worked with, and we went down the North Pass, it's a bass camp on the north side of the river there.
Okay.
And then we took a, this was our first river crossing with a little rubber raft.
Oh, tell me about that. How did that work out?
Well, there's a head story, a beginning story to that. Bill and I had been in touch after we went to drifting, the Hermit, I'm sorry, after we'd done the Bill Hall Thunder River one.
Okay.
And we had been talking, and we talked about, you know, it'd be cool if we could get across the river some of these other places. Yeah, it'd be cool. You know, I know some people, and then he told me, he says, you know, Harvey had crossed the river a couple of times. I read that somewhere or something. And I don't know where he got the information, but I found out later he had talked to Harvey quite a few times.
Okay.
He would call him, and he moved, Harvey moved to Sun City, and CL was in Glendale, and they were, you know, 5 miles apart.
And he said, okay.
You would call Harvey up, and his wife answered the phone while she was still alive there at that time. And you'd say, you want to talk to Harvey, and she'd say, why? You'd say, Grand Canyon. She'd say, oh, and she was never happy to have him on the phone with anybody talking about the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So in any case, he talked to him quite often, so that might have been when Harvey told him about this, about crossing the river anyway.
Okay.
So said, we have to try a trip where we cross the river. And I said, what do you, you know, he says, well, North and South Bass, there's a trail on each side. We can cross over. We can come up to South Bass. He had a guy that he knew that was in Flagstaff that would haul us around and bring us into the trailhead on the North Bass. And he did, and this guy did it. And he said, he'll drop us off. And I don't remember if it was Frank or somebody else, but anyway, would pick us up on the south side at the South Bass and get us out of there. And so we worked it out, and we got, so CL ordered this little boat, and it was a swimming pool boat. It was a vinyl, a big, not big, it was a big for a pool, but it wasn't very big. You could get one person in a pack, or two people in it with their knees all wrapped around each other.
Right.
And you could paddle it. And it came with two little paddles. And he says, well, and we were both living in Phoenix once, and he called me up. He says, let's go down, let's put this in the river, and down where the people do the tubing, and we'll check it out, make sure this is going to work for us.
Well, this is on the Salt River? You're going to put it on the Salt and just play with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we go down there. We blow the thing up. And we both get in, and he puts the oars in. He gives it one pull, and one of the oars busted right there.
Oh, wow.
And we both sighed, wow. It's a good thing we weren't at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So then he went back home, and he ordered, or he found in an outdoor store some paddles that were fairly small. Again, they had to be fairly small. We didn't want anything big. But they had aluminum. They had a good stiff paddle on one end, and aluminum handlebar, or whatever you want to call it, the part of the oar that connected onto the handle on the other end was a hollow aluminum tube, but they were good, solid. And so we tried those out, again, back at the river, and they worked fine. We didn't break them, and we'd stick them into rocks and stuff and everything else. So we knew that we were good there.
So, Charlie, this vinyl raft, did you just blow it up by mouth? With a little stem and a little cap you put in the thing? Or
I'm just an air pump down with it.
Oh, okay.
We had to take two vests.
Life jackets.
Vests, because the Park Service wouldn't give them a permit without, and we had to go show them the boat, which I'm amazed when they saw the boat. They let them go. But we went to the North Rim to pick up our permit, and this was October, you know, it's just when everything's shutting down. But that's where we had to go to get our permit, and we went there to get the permit, and we had to haul out the boat and show them the paddles, and show them they didn't care about the thing we used to blow it. It was one of those things you stand on, like a bellows.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was blow it up, but they wanted to see the life vest and the boat.
Okay.
I didn't know if they were looking for some certification on the boat, because there was really nothing. It was a pool toy, essentially.
Right.
But it did have a little place for an oar lock kind of deal on the edge, so it must have been a little sturdier than a pool toy. But at the time, it did feel that way. Anyway,
yeah.
And so we got it there, and they said, okay, here's your permit. Go ahead and go. And we had fantasies of tying a rope to it, and the person would row across, and then the person on the other side would tow it back. And when we got to the river, we realized we didn't have enough rope, and that was pretty silly anyway. If the thing broke loose on the rope, what are you going to do then?
Right.
You know, so we all, that, we ended up carrying the rope down and back with us. But we went down, and there's a little spring just below the rim when you start down the North Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we by the time we got out there that night or that late afternoon, we camped up on the rim, and we went down there for water. And the guy that had driven us out there had an old Ford station wagon, and he drove us out there. I thought we were going to get stuck between the trees a couple times because that road wasn't very wide.
All right.
And in between the trees and stuff, and he lost his muffler.
Oh, no.
Well, but I guess it was kind of like his work car, so he says, oh, don't worry about that. I'll pick it up on the way back. The rest of the way out to the trailhead, it was booming away, and then he dropped us off and turned around, and I think we each gave him like $10, and there were four of us, so he got $40 for hauling us out there.
Do you remember his name?
I looked in my book, and I just didn't keep those kind of details.
Okay.
I mean, that's where it would have been great to have CL's notes, because he would have known who that guy was right away. And but he worked in the Flagstaff office of the FHA.
Oh.
But he had business in Kanab for some reason, too. I don't know if it was family or whatever. So for him, it wasn't really out of his way. He said, you know, see how it rains. The guy said, you know, as long as you get the flag by this time, I'll take you up there or something like that. So we got up there, and he dropped us off, and it was just at dusk. And so he wandered back out of there in the dark, which must have been a trip in its own right.
Yeah, yeah.
There, those roads out of there in the dark.
Easy to get lost up there. Yeah.
Yeah, easily.
Huh. But, and so from the rim, did you guys go all the way down to Bass Camp like day one or down to the river? How was your schedule there?
We went down, like you said, we spent the night on the rim and we had water. And then we went partway down and we were on the way down, we were on the, what would it be, the upriver side of that canyon as we're going down through there. And we stopped and spent a night, and there were some ruins in that area that were up kind of high on one side. And we went up and investigated those. And there's that place where Cove took the picture with a big rock stuck in the canyon.
The Narrows.
Yeah. And so we did the same thing. We took some pictures in there and went out there. And then it was the third night, though, we were at Bass Camp.
Okay.
Okay. And we joked around there. We got pictures of us, you know, with the, there was, at that time, I don't know if there's anything still there anymore, but there were pots and pans and shears and all kinds of stuff that was still there at that time. And we, I know from there you had to go back up on the ridge and go over to look down at the river because you're above the river at that point, of not real high, but pretty high at that point. And we were standing there talking, and here comes a guy in a Piper Cub. I remember this day, red and white Piper Cub. He had the side where the pilot was folded down so he could look at us, and he flew his flying up the canyon. And I know you can't do any of that stuff anymore, but even in a Piper Cub, that had to be dangerous as hell at that time.
Oh,
he
gosh.
Was just above the river. And he was just putting along that Piper Cub and just kind of waved. We waved, and he just kept going right on up the river.
Huh.
I don't know who he was. I don't know how far he went or what he was doing. But it was just one of those things. You're at the right place at the right time.
Wow.
And I didn't even have a camera to take a picture. I wish I had it at the time.
Hmm.
And I don't know if he turned around and came back or, you know, whatever happened to him. But I knew that plane because my dad had flown a Piper Cub as a private pilot when we were young kids. And, you know, I'd been up with him a number of times. So I knew the plane right away as far as what it was. But it was just kind of funny seeing that little thing putting up through the canyon. But anyway, we were looking down at the river, and that's when we decided we didn't have enough rope and that a rope was probably pretty silly. And then just below that was Shinumo Rapids or whatever
it's
called.
Yeah.
Where the creek comes out. And we wanted to cross above that. And we didn't want to lose the boat down through the rapids and down beyond that for any reason whatsoever. So we decided we were going to cross right below there, and that's also where the cable went across for Bass's, you know, he used to across the river, he had a tram that he hung up at
that's
that
right.
point with a cable across, and we were going to cross right below that. So the next day, then, we went down, and we, when you get down to the river at that point, you can see that there's eddies along the side, that the water's coming back up river right up close to the side.
Yes.
And, but out in the main stream, it's flowing down, of course, downriver, of course, but you could, and this is what they we worked out, when you went across, you're going to be carried down, but as you got close to the other shore, get in that eddy, and then it would carry you back up, and then we would dump out the pack or the person, whichever it was, and then do the same thing coming across the other way. You'd start across, you'd start going down, but when you got close to the wall on the other side, you get close to the enough to get that little eddy, and it would pull you back up along the wall. So we did that. And four people in four packs, when you can only do one person in a pack at a time, became that thing about, you know, the fox and the goose and the and who do you put in the raft at what time? Because you didn't want to leave anybody stranded without a pack.
Right.
So the first person, and it was CL's friend, who actually was from Washington State and was some kind of a fisherman or something at one point in time. So he had better knowledge about the water than we did. Anyway, he rode it across, threw his pack up on the side, then rode back, and CL rode him across, and he got out. And then CL came back and took his pack across, then he came back and took his son-in-law across. And then his son-in-law came back, got his pack, went back, and then he came back, got me, and then I went back to get my pack and get it back across on the other side. So we had all times we had at least one pack on one side in case we got separated somehow or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Six or seven crossings before we got everybody back.
I would imagine that it would have taken you some hours.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're there all morning getting that all straightened away and deciding what we're doing. And then... then we came up to North Kaibab and
South Kaibab.
North of Bass, and we.
Sorry, we came South Bass.
South Bass, yes.
South Bass, sorry, okay.
Yeah, came up South Bass, and there was an old boat that was down there by the river that was a metal one that. I can't remember the whole story with that, but when I went on a raft trip later on, they told us the story about the guy coming down, abandoning the boat, and going out to South Bass Trail. Well, that boat was still there then, and it was there on one of the subsequent trips when CL and I went down to South Bass to go over to the upper end of above, what's that area called, where all the little pools are, where the water is. I'm sorry, I just can't remember names anymore.
No worries.
Pardon?
Not, are you thinking Els Chasm, Royal Arch?
Els Chasm, yeah. We wanted to go above Els Chasm. There was an arch up there.
Okay.
And we wanted to check out that arch. So this, I'll cover that in a few minutes in one of the other walks. But
yeah, so let's finish this one off first. So you worked out your crossing. The Ross Wheeler is the name of that metal boat there. Yeah. And it's still there, I think, today. But then you got to go up the South Bass Trail, and you're hoping that there's going to be somebody up there to meet you at the top.
And there was.
Okay.
And I'm almost certain it was Frank. The best. I mean, he would drop us off and pick us up a lot of times. He kind of got to the point where he didn't want to do much of the hiking, although he did do the one where he lost his watch. But it was almost certainly Frank. I know on the other one that we did subsequent to that, we used a commercial guy out of... the Grand Canyon area there that, you know, took people backpacking.
Okay.
And they dropped us off and picked us up. But in any case, this time we came out and they picked us up and got us back. And then we were back, and that was our adventure on that particular trip. So this is my fourth one with CL then at that time.
Cool.
Yeah. So the two with Grand Canyon and then the one with... to Thunder River, and then the one, for a while we did two a year, and then the one on the Bass, off the South Bass. And then, did you have any other questions about that one?
No, that okay. Sounds like you've got it covered.
Yeah, I remember you could see Doc's Castle and all that stuff from down below, and they looked so grand, and then when you got to the rim, you could hardly find them.
Yeah, when you're down in it looking up, it's like, oh my gosh, there's Fan Island and there's Doc's Castle, spelled D-O-X. Yeah. And then you're up there on the top going, where'd all that stuff go? Down there somewhere.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Huh. So then later that same month, I spent a lot of time in the Grand Canyon.
I'll say, wow.
I got a divorce shortly after that. Anyway, in October, the latter part of October, October 30th to November 2nd, was a trip to have a suit fight with co-workers. And this is the one I talked about. You know, I had to go back down twice to talk some of the people out. And that was the first time we'd been to Havasupai. And that was really cool, the blue water. And it was before a lot of the stuff got washed out in one of the floods. So
yes.
There were big pools and all the travertine. And we went down down below where we had to go down through the little tunnels in the chains.
Mm-hmm.
And down farther. We didn't go all the way to the river, but we went quite a ways down on a day hike and then back up and then back out on another day.
Nice. Was it crowded? This was late October, early November.
Yeah.
Do you remember it being crowded then?
No, not particularly. I don't remember. But we did have a pretty good sized group. We had like 15, 20 people.
Oh, wow. This was from work?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And I can remember getting a permit, and I remember I had to call them back and increase the size of the permit. But at that time, they didn't care. I should say they didn't care. Whoever was responsible said, as long as you give us the money, they didn't say it, but
mm-hmm.
Here's how much more it will cost you. That was essentially it.
Right.
And so when we got there, we just paid the money. They didn't seem to be any concern with overrunning any limit or anything like that. And that was another one. I think that one I just left out. And I think several people, you know, I might have had a tube tent, but I don't think I even used it on that one.
Huh.
It was still nice down at that level in the canyon.
Right.
Okay, mm-hmm. Then 1983. This was the next one. Then into South Pass, we went down South Pass to the Esplanade, and it was in early January, March, or mid April, and a beautiful day. We went down. I was in at that time. I used to wear running shorts, and in fact, we were. I don't know if other people had started then or not, but we'd started looking for lighter boots to hike with, and we were using Nike made a early trail type shoe, and I won't remember what they were called, but It was one of the first trail shoes, and they would break down usually after two backpacking trips, but they were real light, and your feet were cooler and everything else. So
oh, cool.
We started. Pardon?
Oh, cool. I said, yeah, nice.
Oh, yeah. And so we started using those instead of a hiking boot, per se. And we started getting smarter about what we carried. You know, they were carrying a lot less weight. The biggest thing became water, you know, making sure you had enough water to go from place to place.
Right.
But we were going down. Basically, we wanted to get to Royal Creek to the arch above Elk Chasm.
Yep.
And then come back around. We tried to find a way from there right directly down to Elk Chasm. But we didn't have rope, and we just didn't feel that we had a safe way of doing that. So we ended up going around and still using a rope that was hanging there.
Right.
It was hanging at just one area. And Harvey talked about there was rope there, and there was a rope there. And we used the rope as well, and a lot of other people evidently did too, to get through one little stretch down. And then we got to there, and then we were able to make our way down to the river. And we got to the river, and we met up with a couple there, and they were probably in their late 20s, early 30s, a guy and a gal. And she had run an agave into her thigh and broke the needle off into it. And he had actually lowered her. Well, he couldn't find that rope, but they had rope with him, so he actually lowered her down partway to get her down in there. And I thought, okay. I mean, she trusts him. He lowered her down. And then he made his way down. And they did not find that rope that we had used that was hanging there.
Huh.
Anyway, we got to the river, and we talked to them for a while. And they were going to hang out there. They were going to go off the South Pass. And we went on and spent a day then going back up, or at that point, it'd be downriver to to Elf's Chasm, and then back up into Elf's Chasm, far enough where we could still, and climbed up high enough from below, we could get a picture of the Royal, the arch above Royal Creek, or the Royal Arch.
Okay.
So you could get the, just barely get the arch above us, above Elf's Chasm. And we still, from down below, we couldn't see any way that we could have safely, I'm sure
right.
just people take more bigger risks than us that would have done it, but that we could find a way up into that upper part so, without going around. So anyway, then we went back, and they had hiked, started, they had left when we left to go. So when we got back to the camp, we were camped there by that boat there on the sandy beach. And
All the way back up to the Ross Wheeler where you'd crossed.
Right.
Okay.
On the other trip. Right.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, a couple months ago, I'm sure they've done it before, there was a, in the Grand Canyon organization that puts out the magazine and stuff and has all the classes and all that kind of stuff.
The Conservancy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember that they had sent, you know, requesting people to just send a short thing about their favorite thing in the canyon. And I had a picture of Sia and I sitting together. We must have set the camera up somehow to take the picture, sitting there on the river where that boat was down in that area, drinking orange flavored silt and posting each other there on the thing. And, you know, it was just one of the, when I looked at that picture and when I sent it in, and they actually put it in online or something like
that. Oh, that's fun. Oh.
And the little blurb. So.
Cool.
Anyway.
Okay, so when you got to South Bend, did you ever see that couple again? Did they just hike on out?
They did.
Okay.
They left to head out when we went up to Elk's Chasm.
Right.
So we went on up to Elk's Chasm and back in the day, and we spent the night. The next morning, we were heading to the rim. Well, they had hiked partway up that first day, and they went the rest of the way up. But we were coming out, and weather was moving in. And so where I hiked down in my running shorts, we were going out in snow. And it started
Ooh.
Snowing up on the upper parts. And it was a wet snow. It wasn't sticking real well, but it was enough that you put on a lot of clothes. And we got up there, and they were had an old Volkswagen van, and they were inside. They were sitting inside of it. And they had to wait until, they were waiting till the middle of the night for it to freeze because the road had turned into a muddy mess.
Ooh.
And knew they couldn't drive the Volkswagen out until it froze. So they were going to wait, hang out there until it froze. And then they were going to drive out in the middle of the night. So in it, and we had made arrangements with a company that used to be in the old train station down below El Tovar. And they would, you could hire them to take you to trailheads and drop you off or pick you up. And
yeah,
they were due to come out and pick us up.
Who was that? Grand Canyon Treks? Do you remember the name of those? Yeah, who was that?
You know what I mean, though.
Don't yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And there used to be a little outdoor store. They used to have some outdoor gear, but they did, I guess, also take people on regular hikes and things like that. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, trail called. Guides. I'm sorry. I'm farting on their name here, but yeah.
But that was the people we arranged to drop us off and then come back and pick us up. And we expected them, I mean, we'd gotten up there fairly early, even though we just pushed a one day from the river to the rim. And we got up there, it was like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and it was snowing, and it was cold outside. And they saw us, and they said, oh, you know, come on, get in the van. So we got in the van, and they had homemade beer.
Oh, my gosh.
That they had in a milk carton, those metal milk carton things hanging off the back. So they gave us each a beer, and they were popping popcorn in a wok.
Oh, my gosh.
And they had some funny cigarettes that they were smoking.
Huh?
It was a real experience. they were real nice kids. I mean, but CL was never abashed by anything. You know, anything you have, he just took it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of like, I think I know what's going on here, but I'm not sure. I was pretty naive, I guess. But we stayed there, and the truck came, and we exchanged addresses and all this stuff. And that was in October. And around Christmas time, I got a letter from the woman, and they had told us when they were there, they had a big raft folded up in the back of the van. And we asked them about it, and they said, oh, yeah, they had a permit to to do the river like 3 days later or 4 days later. And so they were going to drive out of there. They were going to meet the other people on the river, and they were heading to Lee's Ferry to put in, and they were going to do a raft trip.
Oh, wow.
And
in November of 1983.
Yeah, the end of October, early November. You're right.
Wow.
So we, yeah, because this is the 20th when we are out to the North Rim. And
hang on a second. Let me make sure I got this date right. This is going to be in November of 1983.
No, I got the day wrong. It's April.
April, okay.
April, right. That's what I'm saying. I'm sorry. There's another trip coming up, and I'm looking. I got them all together here, and I jumped down. I shouldn't have. This was in April of '83. We went down on the 16th, and we came out on the 21st in snow.
Okay. So their trip was going to be late April then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And so we were talking to him and all this stuff. And so later that year, it was actually later that year because it was a Christmas card I got from that woman. She said they made it, you know, it froze up. They drove out. They went to Flagstaff's emergency room. And she actually had to stay overnight because they had to put a bunch of stuff into her to keep her from, I guess, it gotten infected.
Oh, wow.
And got the agave thing out of her leg. And then they made it to Lee's Ferry and then did the raft trip.
Oh, good for them.
It all worked out for them.
Huh.
I never heard from them again after that. But it was one of those things when you run into people in the canyon, it just happens to happen sometimes.
How cool is that?
Interesting situation.
Oh, very fun. And that was a good trip for you guys, too.
Yeah. We had a great time. And then...
You know what? Hey, Charlie, we've been going now. Where are we at here?
Okay.
All right. Hour 10 minutes or so. This sounds like a good place to put a comma in this interview series.
Okay.
And we'll pick it up again following your Grand Canyon work here, trip by trip by trip.
Yeah.
And is there anything else about the material we've covered here that you want to bring in that you didn't?
No, I can't think of anything. I don't know. Do you have any questions? Do you think I left?
No. I think this is good. I just, I don't know what else to ask. And, there's a heron there. Remember, what happened to that heron got in your backpack? Well, I don't know to ask you about that. And so if you don't tell me, I won't ask. Okay. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Schultz. Today is Thursday, March 9th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Charlie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.